Kia ora, tēnā koto katoa. Welcome to Emrin's Podcast, episode 353. Today is Friday, April 16th, 2021. Well, last time when I talked about the halcyon days of the old Emrin's Podcast and how I used to podcast on Tuesdays and Fridays, I didn't expect that I would podcast on the Friday of that week or of this week either. But, you know, things just work out the way they do. I'd originally planned on podcasting yesterday and ran out of time. So I didn't. But I think that going forward, I'm going to try to podcast on Thursdays, my time, which is, Wednesday in North America, because of a discussion I had with George in Atlanta over on the Emrin's Facebook page. He was asking, having listened to my previous episode, if I had any information on vaccination rates in New Zealand and Australia. And I didn't. Now, in my defense, well, first of all, I never thought about looking it up. But beyond that, I do recall that the media was asking about that. And at the time, the ministry said there wasn't much point in releasing that sort of data because they just weren't doing enough to worry about, really. And so I didn't think to look to see if that had changed. Well, it has changed. The numbers are only being released weekly, again, because it's still so small. I don't know that they're ultimately going to do daily updates. They may do. I don't know. But for now, it's weekly, and they do the data as of 11:59 p.m. on Wednesday night, our time, and then it's actually released publicly the following day on Thursday, usually around 1 p.m., because that's when they usually do their general updates of number of positive cases in managed isolation and so on. So, as of this week, there have been 135,585 doses given, which is about 2.65% of the population. And we're still in the early stages of the program. Our program is basically about getting border workers and the people in the managed isolation facilities, MIQ they're called, which stands for Managed Isolation and Quarantine, getting all of them vaccinated, and then moving beyond that, which they've already started doing. So the numbers vaccinated should be going up in the weeks ahead. But that 135,585 vaccines is made up of the total number of first doses and the total number of second doses. Total number of first doses is 105,391, which is a little over 2% of the population. But the number of second doses is 30,194, which is less than 1%. It's 0.59% of the population. And that is the number that, to me, is the more significant of those three, because those people are fully vaccinated and, theoretically anyway, at less risk for themselves and possibly of infecting others. But New Zealand will be getting all of its vaccines, and again, we're using only Pfizer, will be getting all of them by the end of the year, which means that at the moment, the government expects to have all New Zealanders vaccinated by October, November of this year. And there's a long way to go to get there, and there could be some disruption to the supply, mainly because of the problems with the other two vaccines, the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson. The problem with the two vaccines, not the other two, because there's also Moderna. Anywho, that could disrupt distribution as some of the more developed countries pull rank, essentially, and get what they want. But the thing of it is that New Zealand has no active cases of COVID-19 in the community. There's no transmission in the community. So we arguably don't need the vaccine as much as other countries do, like India or Brazil or the US or UK or other countries. And nobody's dying here of COVID, and people are dying in other countries. And so if our process ultimately slows down in order to break the massive spike in cases in various countries, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't make us any less safe, potentially, but it does mean that it will keep some people like me a bit anxious a bit longer. Now, the question is, how does this compare to Australia? And until recently, they were doing really well. The rollout started. They reached about 4.5% of the population. I think that's total doses, not both doses. But I don't know that part, actually. But it doesn't really matter because everything's blown up now. They were using a lot of the AstraZeneca vaccine because there's a manufacturing facility in Australia making it. And because of the potential problem with blood clots, they've decided that they're going to restrict that only to people over 50. And they're ordering in Pfizer vaccines to do the bulk of the vaccinations in the country, but they're not going to get those until the end of the year. So by the time they get their vaccines, New Zealand could be fully vaccinated. And by fully, I mean all the people are going to be, pretty much. And by that time, we should have herd immunity here. So this all, of course, has implications for the travel bubble, because if the vaccination program is slow, then that means that travelers between the two countries are going to have to be extra careful to record their movements. And that's easier on our side of the Tasman, because there's one app for the entire country. No matter where you go, you scan in. But in Australia, each state has their own, and they're slightly different, and you can't just, you know, go from one state to another. And I heard one expert on the news the other day talking about this very thing and saying that it's now too late to try to merge the vaccines because they've continued to develop them, and they're not compatible anymore. The data that they collect isn't mergeable, so he said. I don't know that myself, but, you know, it's his field, not mine, so I'll take his word for it. So there is going to be a lot of attention to personal responsibility that people are going to have. And I will be brutally honest, I'm less worried about that among New Zealanders than I am among Australians. And the reason is that we just don't have the level of nuttiness that Australia does. They've got these people who stage anti-mask protests and all of that other sort of carry-on, all this Q bullshit. They have a lot of that. We don't have much of that. And certainly nothing visible. We don't have mass protests and things like that. So I'm a bit worried that some of those people might come over to New Zealand and decide, oh, well, screw you. You're impinging on my freedom. I'm not going to scan in, sort of a thing, even though they're required to, or sign in the log book that each business has to have. And that could theoretically anyway create real problems, because if one of them is infected, spreads it to New Zealand, it will be not impossible, but extremely difficult to do contact tracing, which is the whole point of the tracer app anyway. It's to record your movements so that if you do become infected or someone who is infected is in your presence, it's faster and easier to do the contact tracing and to get you tested and all that sort of stuff. So that is my worry about the travelers from the two countries. And I mean, most Australians are like most New Zealanders. You know, they'll do the right thing and they'll make a point of doing this, of downloading the New Zealand app so they can scan when they're here and all that sort of stuff. So for the most part, I have no worries. And the odds of somebody that I'm talking about, some resistor, refusing to do their part and infecting others and spreading it and so on, is really, really small. Not the least because they don't have widespread community outbreaks in Australia either. They've had a bit more than we have, I think, overall. I think that's fair. But it's a really rare thing. But it is nevertheless something that is a possibility. And I am wondering what the authorities on both sides of the Tasman are going to do to ensure compliance. I mean, if they find that somebody's refusing to comply, are they going to deport them, or what are they going to do? I don't know. Probably nothing, because that's usually what happens. All the Australians will probably deport a Kiwi, but I don't know that New Zealand would. But so that's just another thing to add into the worry basket about this whole thing. But all of this whole vaccination thing is an issue because, as I said last time, the border is the one way that the virus can get loose in New Zealand. And if we get a massive number of New Zealanders vaccinated, the odds of it spreading are greatly reduced. But we still are at risk with so few people vaccinated. Just recently, we had a security guard at an MIQ facility test positive, And there's been a lot of back and forth about who's at fault, because this particular worker wasn't tested since November, and workers in MIQ and border facilities are supposed to be tested every 2 weeks, and he wasn't tested since November. Now, there can be some legitimate reasons why people aren't tested. For instance, it doesn't show up as on time because they're, say, 2 or 3 days late in getting it done. Or they might have been on annual leave during that time, or they might have not been working in an MIQ facility. You know, things are fluid like that. Nevertheless, he has not been tested since, and I think it's a he because he's been referred to as a he, since November. And the government is alleging that his employer wasn't doing adequate follow-up. And the employer said, oh, well, the government didn't flag his case as being untested until March 26th, implying that it's the government's fault. Well, quite frankly, it's not the government's fault that the employer wasn't maintaining their own register to make sure that all of their staff are vaccinated. Now, it is true that the government should have been keeping their own register all along to make sure that there weren't untested workers in the facilities, but that didn't happen until recently. But that doesn't absolve the employer of responsibility for making sure that all of their staff were getting their biweekly tests, because that's a requirement under law. It's not like it's a nice thing to do. It's a requirement. So it doesn't really matter who is ultimately right or wrong. What matters is that this guy went, 5 months without a test and ultimately ended up testing positive down the road. And the employer has to bear some of the responsibility for that, whether they like it or not, in my opinion. And this is going to become a bigger issue at the end of the month, because at that point, any worker who is not vaccinated will not be permitted to work at an MIQ facility. And it doesn't matter if they work for the government or if they work for a private contractor, they will not be permitted to work. End of story. No recourse. That could mean that some of them will end up losing their jobs if they refuse to be vaccinated, because the employer has the option of assigning them to a different location that has nothing to do with MIQ, because they're a security firm. You know, they provide guards for all kinds of places. But if they don't have any positions for these people and they refuse to be vaccinated, they're going to end up losing their job. And they don't have a recourse, because vaccination is mandatory for people in those positions. If their employer doesn't have a position for them, they're going to have to let them go. And that's just the way it is. The vaccine itself is optional. No one is being required to get vaccinated. But certain positions, like in MIQ facilities, it is mandatory that the workers be vaccinated. And if they can't or won't be vaccinated, then they have to be put in a different position. That's easier for government to do, obviously, because they can shift them around. They don't have to worry about bottom lines and profits and all that sort of stuff. But one would hope that companies would do the responsible thing and just transfer the employee to somewhere else where they can continue to work without losing their job because they refuse or can't be vaccinated. And those are two different things, by the way. Somebody might refuse to be vaccinated for all sorts of reasons, some of them nutty, some of them not. And there are other people who can't be vaccinated because of some health issue or, you know, whatever. There could be legitimate reasons in a few cases. But we're not done with this by a long stretch. But this part is important, that everyone at an MIQ facility be vaccinated, because, as I said, that's the way that the virus will get loose in the community, is through the border. And on April 6th, the Prime Minister announced that all arrivals from India would be suspended from April 11th to the 28th, I think it is. And that's because they're in the midst, as you've probably heard in the news, India is in the midst of a massive surge in the number of infections and deaths. And it turns out that they're centered on the mass wave is primarily centered in the three areas where people fly out of. And what they believe is happening is that people are traveling to those cities to fly to New Zealand and becoming infected when they arrive in that city, maybe at the airport, around the airport, whatever. But that's how they're getting infected. So in that sense, it's irresponsible to expose them to that level of risk when there's no way to protect them. But on the other hand, the government's first duty is to protect New Zealand from this virus entering the country. And since the end of February, there were, between the start of February, rather, and April 8th, there were 117 cases that showed up in MIQ facilities. And India, sorry, there weren't 117 cases. There were 117 cases from India between the start of February and April 8th. And that was more than half of all of the cases that came in. And just for comparison, the USA was in second place with 17, and the UK was in third with 11. So clearly, India was posing a danger to us, to New Zealand, and also to the passengers coming from India. So the only logical thing is to call a pause while we either try to figure out a solution or hope that the Indian authorities manage to start get their wave under control. But my gut feeling is it will probably be extended into May sometime. But a lot will depend on if they can figure a workaround of some sort. But I do know that what this applies to is anyone, citizen or permanent resident from India, or who has spent time in India in the past couple of weeks, will not be allowed to fly to New Zealand. And I heard in the news today, I don't have a citation for this, but the plan is that airlines flying New Zealanders to New Zealand will no longer stop in Australia. And part of that is to reduce this problem of potential bleed, if you want to call it that, where a transit passenger in Australia might end up accidentally infecting somebody in Australia, and then that spreads to New Zealand as well. So by having them fly a different route, and I don't know any of the details on how this is going to work, theoretically anyway, it should make the travel bubble between Australia and New Zealand safer. But we shall see. So all of these things are related. All of these things are connected. The vaccination rates, the fact that we still have problems with workers at the border, that we had a massive spike coming from a country with a massive spike in cases, and also even the fact that the passengers returning to New Zealand from other countries will no longer be flying through Australia. That's all related to this whole problem of the fact that there aren't enough people vaccinated in either country, or any country really, and that an abundance of caution is still required, and I think will be for many, many months to come. But this is going to be an ongoing story. Now, I am going to update that number every week, the number of vaccinations, probably only the second dose one, maybe, or maybe second in total, I don't know, just so it's a bit quicker. And probably most weeks I won't say anything more about it other than that, but it's a way to kind of keep an eye on what's happening. I ended up starting my own spreadsheet to keep track of this because I couldn't find historic data on the government website. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to just make my own sheet, which had a side benefit because I could put a formula in the spreadsheet to automatically calculate the percentages for me so I don't have to do that every time. Saves me time, saves me energy. And as my friend Jason will readily point out, arithmetic is not my friend. So anyway. So that's one of the big things that's going. And all of this is technically working to a plan for vaccinations. There are not targets as such, but there is a plan that the government is following that it hopes to ultimately see come true, I guess. And they were running behind where they wanted to be according to the plan, but they've since moved ahead. Now, personally, I think the difference between a plan and targets is kind of semantics, but be that as it may, that's part of the problem that Australia ran into because they had huge targets and all of a sudden they couldn't meet them anymore because of their vaccine problems. Meanwhile, I've also been working on plans for here, for myself, for my house. And I've talked before about some of the things I've done. I know I've talked a lot on my blog about the things I've done to the house and been doing to the house. And for a bit of background, my goal has been, first of all, to make the house the way I want it, but secondly, in some ways more important, I'm trying to get it ready for my retirement, which is only a few years away now, and I want to make it comfortable and affordable and easy to deal with in future years. So I'm doing what I can now while I still can, and I'm concentrating on the things I can't do myself. I mean, I can do planting in the garden, even if it takes me a year or two to finish it. I can do that myself. But there's certain things I can't do. And I wanted to put in a ducted air conditioning system. In New Zealand, when we say air conditioning, we mean heating and cooling, not just cooling. And I looked into it, and it was $16,000 and up to do this house, which is a relatively modest three-bedroom house. It's not huge. And that's very expensive. And I thought about it, and I thought, I just can't justify spending that much money when what I essentially want to do is make two rooms comfortable, my bedroom and the main living area, the lounge, kitchen, and dining area. So I ended up putting in a system that's called HRV, which stands, I think it's heating, recovery, ventilation or something. And it has a unit in the attic space, which draws in fresh air, because it's always fresh up in an attic, because there's air circulation. And in the summertime, at night, it sends the cooler air in the attic down into the house, which cools it down. It also introduces fresh air and changes the air, because modern houses are really quite well sealed, and without that, they might not get fresh air. And I've noticed, actually, in this house, I have a weather station. I think I talked about that many years ago, that Nigel originally got, and I got it working again here, all by myself with no help. And it had, among other things, it has a CO2 detector, and I frequently see, especially in the afternoon, that the CO2 levels are going up. And so the HRV system helps with all of that. In the wintertime, it does the opposite. When the attic starts to heat up when the sun comes up, then it takes the hot air up there and sends it down into the house, which in wintertime is cooler. And just this morning when I got up, it was running. It was running at full blast because the speed of the fan varies depending on the temperature difference. And it really warmed it up really quite quickly. So far, I've been really happy with the system. And it cost a fraction of what a ducted air conditioning system would have cost. I should say I've got a heat pump in both the master bedroom and the living space. It's only the other two bedrooms that don't have anything at the moment. And eventually I'm going to come up with a solution for them too. But that's not today. I don't know when I'm going to get that sorted. And because I'm not spending all that money on air conditioning, I decided I was going to spend it on putting photovoltaic cells on the roof to generate electricity. Now, that's a complicated thing because there's the panels themselves. There's an inverter, which makes the power usable by the house. And I had to have a new meter installed on the outside of the house, which happened just yesterday. And its job is to be able to determine where the power is coming from, so that I get charged for power I'm taking from the national power grid, and I get paid for the power I send to the national power grid. And with any luck, over time, they will even out, I'll make a little bit of money from my excess power. But the thing is that if I do energy-intensive things in the daytime, like, say, do the washing and run the dryer, run the dishwasher, maybe do my ironing, do, I don't know, baking or whatever. Anything that's energy intensive, if I do that in the daytime, it's free, essentially. And apart from my outlay for the equipment. But the system I bought also has, I got a better inverter than the basic because I wanted one that would be ready to go for a plug-in hybrid. I don't have a plug-in hybrid yet, but New Zealand is moving toward ending the importation of petrol-driven vehicles. And so eventually, I'm going to need to upgrade to a plug-in hybrid, and the system I've got will be able to accommodate that fairly easily. I did not get a battery set for nighttime power because they're too expensive. The main one that's sold in New Zealand is the Tesla Powerwall, and it's $16,000 and up. And it's just not, I can't justify that expenditure, because batteries are problematic for a lot of reasons, for ecological reasons, for social reasons, and also reasons of exploitation and so on. They're really problematic, and particularly because there's no way to recycle them in New Zealand right now. So the lifetime is really short. You spend a lot of money for something that doesn't last very long, and there's no way to recycle them. I think, and Nigel explained this to me in great detail one day when I wasn't paying, well, it's not that I wasn't paying attention. I couldn't understand him. let's be honest here. But basically, I think that eventually plug-in hybrid cars are going to become the power wall, if you will, for houses with solar power systems, because their battery capacity is greater than most power walls, and the amount that you need at night, especially when you're sleeping, is very small. In my case, it's just to run the hot water heater, pretty much, or I suppose the HRV too, but that doesn't use much power. You know, I'm not running the dryer or the dishwasher, and not running the TV or anything like that. So I think that's what's going to happen ultimately. But in the meantime, what sparked all of this is that Nigel and I both wanted to be as sustainable and self-sufficient as possible. That was sort of our, I suppose it's a dream more than a plan or anything. He had visions even of being self-sufficient in food. Now, I wasn't as keen on that idea because I knew that meant that he was wanted me to grow it. And that was would have been a lot of work for me. Although he spent a lot of time paying attention to our tomatoes in his last couple of years. So it's entirely possible that he would have been interested in other things growing too. But he was particularly interested in being self-sufficient in power. And so he looked into wind turbines and he bought a big one. It's like a small plane engine. It's not really, but that's what it feels like. And he wanted to put it up at our old house. And I said, I'm not sure about this because our house was a quarter acre surrounded by six other houses on all our boundaries. And I said, you know, people complain about these things. In this situation, we're going to get constant complaints. And I guess he must have listened to me or something because he ended up dropping the idea. He got a smaller turbine instead, a vertical axis one, axis, because where we were, the winds were variable and shifted directions fairly frequently, and supposedly it's better, and supposedly it's quieter. I don't know. He never got anywhere with that one either. And part of it is because he was trying to figure out a storage solution for it, some sort of battery wall thing, but he was looking up how to build one himself, because it would have been a fraction of the cost of a Tesla one. But he never got to see all of that. So part of what I'm doing, I had two goals. One goal was to try to get the house as self-sufficient as possible before my retirement. But the bigger goal is to make Nigel's dream come true in my way, a way that made sense for me. I knew I couldn't deal with the wind turbine because I wouldn't be able to maintain it. I wouldn't know how. I wouldn't know what to do. It was beyond me in every sense of the word. And it's also way up in the air. So that wasn't a goer. It never was. But solar power, once it's installed, you basically just let it go and do its thing. You don't have to do anything. And so that I can handle, that I could do. It ultimately was more expensive than his turbine was because he got a really good deal. But that's not installed or anything. It's, you know, just the equipment. I ended up selling the turbine to somebody who lives elsewhere in New Zealand who is in an off-the-grid place, because it would have cost something like $150,000 or $200,000 to run power to their property, and that was just, you know, out of reach. So he had the same turbine, but it had broken down, and he needed one that works, because the company that built it went bankrupt, and all of the stock and supplies and spare parts and all that were sold off. So there's no way to do that unless you hire an engineer to fix it, and that can be really dodgy. So he actually needed it, and I know that if Nigel was alive, he would have sold it to him for that very reason. So that was one thing I took care of. And ultimately, when the system's up and running, I should be near or at self-sufficiency. And that's based on what my power use has been so far. It's impossible to know for sure what I'm going to end up getting, but you know I'll have a spreadsheet to track it. But we'll see. The system is not running at the moment because there's one last piece in this puzzle picture, and that's that the installation has to be inspected because two things. It connects to the national power grid, so that has to be up to scratch. And the other thing is that it's made alterations to the circuit breaker and how power comes into the house and how it's distributed, and they have to make sure that that all meets code. And so that is still to happen. They haven't contacted me yet about doing that. And when they do, then once it's signed off, I'll get what's called a certificate of code compliance. And once I have that, that means it's all legal and code compliant, and I can turn it on. And then I'll be generating my own power from that point onward in the daytime, or daylight anyway. I'm looking forward to that. I have no idea when I'm going to be able to do it. And tempting though it definitely is to turn the system on and see what happens, it's not a good idea, because if I did that and there was an electrical fire and it turned out that the solar system was the fault and it hadn't been signed off by the inspectors, that means my house and contents insurance probably wouldn't pay the claim, and I would be out, whatever the cost was. So it's a really strong incentive to wait until the inspection is done. But that's what I've been up to lately. I've been doing some these big projects around the house that I can't do. My next one is I'm going to get some sort of pergola cover or something put over my patio, which is in the side of my house. If you, from the street, it's on the right side. Not that that will mean anything to you, but that's where it is. So that's where I'm at. Those are the plans I'm working on. That's the plans I have completed. And I know that there will be more to come. Now, as I said early on, my plan is to do new episodes on Thursdays. We'll see how that goes. But that is the plan. And if you think that's a good idea, you can always let me know, either at the website or in the Amarin's Facebook page, or whatever method makes you happy. But that's it for today. That's it for this week. And I'll talk to you relatively soon. Kakete ano. Bye. You can comment on this or any episode of the Amarin's Podcast at amarinspodcast.com, where you can also leave a voice message. You can visit and comment on the Amarin's Facebook page, or you can email me, with or without a voice message, at amarins@gmail.com. This podcast is a proud member of the Pride 48 Network and is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.